studying are the words that God used to describe what happened at the cross, what His Son. And I need to make one correction to a comment made last week. We were talking about who killed Jesus, and I'd made the point that we all did. And I thought about it on the way home and said, no, that's half correct. There's another half that says, no, nobody did. We all tried to. But He said, I lay down my life and I take it up. No man takes it from me. So let's be really clear that the decision to die on the cross was made by the one that did it for us. Very clearly. It wasn't He was pushed into a corner by us mud balls with hair and teeth. Remember, this was God. And He said, I lay it down and I take it up again. So you have to understand sort of both sides. We all tried, and we would have had we had the chance at some level. And there's in a very metaphorical sense, of course, we do it every day. So what we've been looking at are the terms that God used to describe what happened at the cross. Where historians will look at it, and you saw this Galilean upstart, young Jewish man from northern Galilee, from Galilee, executed by the Roman government, abandoned by his local government, betrayed by his followers, his inner circle, where God would sit there and look and say, aha, I did it. It's the greatest triumph in all of history, and you had better be thankful that it happened that way. You'd better be happy that it thanked that way, or else guess who would be in that situation? Eventually yourself. This was that substitute thing. And we studied last year the big word that God uses to describe this, and it was sacrifice, if you remember that. And the notion of sacrifice wasn't what sometimes it's like. Sometimes people understand that a sacrifice was something that they gave up to try to buy off God, to pacify a God or something of this type. And a sacrifice, if you remember what we said, had nothing to do with that. A sacrifice was an expression of trust in the fact that in the agricultural setting, I was dependent upon the sheep and my flock. I was dependent upon those goods to give me crops for the future. And so when I sat there and said, I'm going to take part of this and give this into this system, into this priesthood, to share it with somebody else as opposed to me and my family, I'm trusting God for my future. I'm trusting that He's actually involved in my life. And so it was an expression of trust, or faith we would call today, much as praying for Christ to come into your life. It's not the prayer that does dip. You know, that's just another ritual. You know, nor was the sacrifice anything. It was that heart that said, okay, here I am, God. I recognize there's a dependency, and I want to start a dance with You. I want to start the dance. I want You in my life, swirling around, intervening. I want to interact. I want a personal relationship with You. That's as simple as it was. It recognized that there was a need on our part for this God, that God indeed was bigger than us and smarter than us and better than us, and that our hopes to reach the complete fulfillment of who we were designed to be, our full potential, was only going to be in a relationship with the one that actually blueprinted us, the one that wrote the owner's manual. You can sit there and check it, check the tech specs. Yeah, you don't try doing it this way. You do it this way. And so that opened up the whole realm of possibility for a relationship with God. And then we move to the second one, but let me take Ted's comment.
Like Abraham doing that kind of sacrifice.
Yes, absolutely. The sacrifice, the almost sacrifice of, it was a heart sacrifice of Isaac. Absolutely. I mean, and what happened was, is that when he got there, if you remember what Ted's alluding to there, is that story of where the promise was so, God said, you know, through this dude, you know, I'm going to bless the whole world. We're going to do all this stuff. This individual, Isaac. Now, I want you to go and kill him. Right? And, matter of fact, don't do it right now. I want you to think about this for 3 days. So I want you to head out for 3 days, and I'm not going to give you the hint. And I'll let you worry about the contradiction that I just gave you about this sacrifice. You'll have to figure out how this is going to come to a good ending. But you're the human. I'm the God. You trust me in the meantime. You trust me in the meantime. So he goes 3 days, you know, in this thing, and he does this thing, and he knows that somehow, according to the book of Hebrews, that even if God had not stopped him for some reason, okay, that he killed him, guess what? He gets him back. Because God can't break the promise that God is reliable. That God is omni-reliable. And so, yeah, absolutely, it was an expression strictly of faith. It wasn't that he was doing good, as the pagan nation said, I can do good by sacrificing my kids. Israel later did it worse than all the nations around them, child sacrifice. Much worse. Okay. Yeah, and they were trying to buy off a deity as opposed to this was a matter of a very clear instruction. You know, when God faults Israel for child sacrifice, he says, you have done this, and this never entered in my mind, and I never spoke to you a word about this. And so this was an occasion of extreme moral violence on the part of God. Was you find it through the prophets. They're always oppressing people, but he'll always add there, and spilling the blood of innocents. You kill your kids in the ravines where they would do this. And there were other places that they sacrificed their children that are more famous, but we won't go into that now. So, sacrifice was this just basic statement of, I trust. I'm going to take a statement of faith here. I'm going to trust. And we're on the one now, and that just sort of starts the relationship. It starts a relationship. It all sort of starts there. And it's that step toward God. And the one we're on now is one of the sweet, really sweet ones that has to do with freedom. This is, we're on the word redemption and ransom. And ransom looks more at the cost, which we'll start seeing today. But redemption is this old word for freedom. That's what it was. Being bought out of freedom, for freedom. Bought out of slavery, bought out of captivity. I was reading this morning some, I think it was 142, it might have been 147, where David is in a cave. And he asked God to free him from his prison. Now, there are no bars on the cave, but everybody's in a cave in different places of their lives, in different times, in different areas. And it is just as dark, and you can't get out because the second you step out, some marauding army is going to kill you. And so you hide in the back in the dark and the moist, and you worry about the eyes that you see in the, you know, and all this kinds of stuff. And we all have those areas of our lives that we're still in the caves. And this is the message that, this was the second big word that he used, was freedom. It was basically a freedom motif. He really apparently cares about this to the point that he gives us way too much freedom. That's a separate problem. We have, he's... Like I say, I've told you many times before that I don't have special attacks against me by the evil one that I can recognize because I seem to do a good enough job messing my life up myself. This is the old, let's give Glenn another 4 feet of rope. Let's just back out. I don't want to get involved here and get God involved here too. Let's just let Glenn, give him a little extra rope, he'll hang himself. He'll mess something up and you get muddled and everything, things of this type. And so I'll find myself sold into slavery or hiding in some cave. And this is the message you always come back to. And what we've been doing is taking that word. Remember, it wasn't a holy word back then. It wasn't in any hymns back then. That word redemption, my Redeemer liveth, stuff like that wasn't around there. If you sang that, basically, my Redeemer liveth, that meant that whoever was going to buy you from your existing master was still alive and kicking. And there was hope for you to switch ownership, remember. That's what that my Redeemer liveth back then. And we're on page now... We're actually on page 13, and we switched last week from the bad news to the good news. Now, the bad news that we studied about was when you use that redemption word in the first century, when Paul and Jesus and the apostles would have used this, they would immediately recognize that as a market term. That's an economic term for buying somebody out of slavery or out of captivity. And so it was an economic, and if somebody used the redemption word, the first question that was asked was what? How much? How much? That was the first question that's always asked in that period of time when somebody uses the redemption word. It's, how much are we talking? How much money are we talking to spring this dude? Okay? And what we saw last week was the central statement of this in Mark 10, where Jesus, the night before he dies, he's very, very clear. He says, I came not to be served, but to serve others and to give my life as a ransom for many. So he said, I've got a very specific purpose here. It's not to be worshipped. It is not to be honored. It is not for people just to do all this other stuff for me. No, I've got a purpose. You may do that. That's a separate issue. You may be called to do that yourselves, disciples. My calling is very specifically, put you first, other first, and go after that in pursuit of your benefit. So I'm going to be a ransom. That's what I came to do. The only person ever born to die. And so we looked at the relationship, the fact that Mark is throughout the Gospel of Mark, there's all these allusions back to Isaiah 53, all those suffering servants. Remember we talked about that, the Isaiah passages, where for some reason the Messiah of the Old Testament, of ancient Israel, was supposed to be this Davidic king, that this wonderfully powerful figure that's going to usher in righteousness, and it's going to be such a righteous place that the nations are going to be excited about having Israel rule. It's going to be that substantial that nobody's going to say, well, no, I want to be peers, or I want to be greater than. It's that trade-off thing. When I get a society that's free of violence and oppression and families, no treachery, sign me up. Yep, no, I don't want to be the head anymore. That's right, I'll turn in my membership card for being a leader. And that was the hope. But to get there, they had this view of the Messiah that was David. Although the rabbis understood that David had a hard time too. So when David was in his caves, the later rabbis would talk about how even the Davidic king, Messiah, would be persecuted and go through trials and tribulations. That it wasn't going to all be, the Messiah comes in and poof, speaks the word and it's all done. All of us get converted. We're all good all of a sudden. Okay? And that David was going to have his time. And then there was a second Messiah. Remember, Messiah ben Joseph. We talked about this. There was Messiah ben David, son of David. Messiah ben Joseph, who was the suffering one. That there was a Messiah in all the rabbinic literature. And they didn't know how to put the suffering Messiah together with the Davidic Messiah. And they would struggle with this. And they never there was no clean way to put this together in their lives, in their theology. And so they assumed that ben Joseph was going to be killed by the Gentiles. And that to pay them back for killing Messiah ben Joseph, Messiah ben David would show up and then execute, be the Goel Redeemer, and execute vengeance for Messiah ben Joseph. See, they put these together. And Isaiah 53, the servant songs, is where you had that picture of the suffering Messiah. That God said the way to get from good to the best is through this suffering. It's not yours. It's my suffering. I'll take this. None of you seem to be qualified or will sign up to go do this. There was no person to stand in the gap, so my own arm, he said, wrought salvation for me and for my people. Okay? So, we've gone through that, and we're now in the middle of page 13 with the two words that we're talking about. Remember, there were three words I overviewed. I'll probably never get to this. I keep reviewing this material this morning for some reason. As I'm wont to do. There were three sets of words that were Greek words that are translated in our English Bibles as redemption. Okay, there were three sets of words. One is the one that we're talking about now, lutro, lutron. And that word is basically that word for ransom. It's that slave one. And it's where you bought someone and set them free. So lutron was you bought them and set them free. You bought them and set them free. Okay. The second set of words that we'll come to in a couple of weeks have to do with you buy them and you keep them. Okay. And that's the word, the Greek word that's up on the wood there in the sanctuary. You are bought with a price. Therefore, you are not your own. Okay. So that's a change of ownership word. That's, again, a commercial word. And the third one that's only used once in the New Testament, has to do with the buying, but the emphasis is not upon the act of buying, but the thing bought as being a treasured possession. What I bought is treasured to God. That God bought me, and therefore He treasures me and us and delights. And so it's not just, yeah, I bought it, I'll put it on the trophy. No, this is a lamb, the lamb of 1 Samuel. He finished that one, sorry. So these are the three words. We're on Litron, an anti-Litron. And we've got one word. Paul makes up a word, anti-Litron. Now look at this. We're in the middle. 1 Timothy 2:3.
who desires all men to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. For there is one God and one mediator also between God and men, the man Christ Jesus, who gave himself as a ransom for all, the testimony born at the proper time. Now notice there I've got litron is the word that's translated ransom. So if you've got a pen, underline ransom there in the verse. Draw an arrow from litron, ransom, up to ransom. And then the anti is the word for. And anti is a strong word that means in the place of. And that's the word for right after the word ransom. So ransom in the place of all. And so Paul puts those words together, anti-litron, and he gets the phrase ransom for, and then there's a separate word for all. When Jesus, in the Mark 10 passage, he said, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom, lutron, for many. The for is anti. So Paul here is referring very specifically to what Jesus said. He takes litron, anti, and just puts them together in one word. And the emphasis is so clear on this is a substitute. See, you could do one of two things. I mean, conceptually, if Glenn was a servant, a domestic slave back in the Roman Empire, and like I said, domestic slaves would normally be freed by the right around 30 years of age, and we talked about that, how it was so different from New World slavery. But somebody could buy me, you know, with money, but they could just as well barter. There were things that they could trade goods and services for me. And conceptually, although we only know of one or two cases, they could trade places. Somebody could actually take my place, and then I would go free. See? And masters and owners would make that decision just pure economic. You know, is somebody bigger, stronger, and smarter and better looking than Glenn? Does he wear better clothes than Glenn? Does he, you know, those kinds of things. And said, yeah, that's a good deal for me. Okay? That's what this verse is talking about, where somebody literally took that place. Instead of just paying money out of God's whole vast resources, okay, he did something much more precious. Right? He sent his son and did that himself. Okay, so that's what this focus is on this verse. Not so much the fact that I got free, but the focus here was at the cost. Because guess what? When I go free, I'm going to look back at the cost, and I'm going to see love. Because that's another thing I want, and not just freedom. There are other things I need than just freedom, believe me. And one of them is this relationship with God. And one of the things I need is a view of God that is truer to his good heart than the stereotypes that we have in our civilization, a lot of times in our churches and things of this type, where we've got God is not as good-hearted, not as doesn't lead with grace first, doesn't lead with love first, lead with patience, lead with forgiveness. Long-suffering is what we use the word for. We normally apply that to us in our lives, whining about the various things that we do, you know, the little problems that we have. And God's long-suffering is putting up with our whining and our various and sundry other things and not being thankful for the massive amount of good that exists in our life all the time that we don't acknowledge very often. And this word here, like I say, focuses upon the cost of that price, the cost of that act to give us freedom and give us the possibility for freedom. And with this all background now, we're ready in the remaining minutes to jump into the New Testament passages. Okay, on E. Now, we're going to go through the New Testament passages for the word that for this first set of words, this buying and setting free. Buying and setting free, okay? Remember, one of the things was the quiz on last week. If you were bought and set free, and those of you that weren't here last week, you're exempted. But if you were bought and set free in an actual magistrate environment, in the court system, besides your freedom, what else did you get? Citizenship, absolutely. Good. And that was citizenship in Rome, and that was very difficult to obtain. That was very difficult to obtain. Okay. Now, I had one verse from Josephus. this word antelutron starts showing up after New Testament times, and one of the places it shows up is in Josephus. And Josephus tells a story, writing in the first century A.D. It was the priest who was the guardian of the sacred treasures in the temple, and his name was Eleazar. When he saw that Crassus, the Roman, was busy in gathering money and was in fear for the entire ornaments of the temple, he, Eleazar, gave him, Crassus, this beam of gold as a ransom for the whole temple. But this not till he had given his oath that he would remove nothing else out of the temple but be satisfied with this only. In other words, Crassus was going to get there and just clean out all the ornamentation, you know, of the temple. Take it all as booty, as plunder. Okay? Eleazar, who had responsibility for everything in the thing, said, well, I tell you what, why don't you, let's make a swap. Let's make a deal. Will you take this bar of gold that we've got? It's not part of this, this bar of gold, and take that antilutron. Take that as a ransom to free your evil plots against all this other stuff. Will you take this in place of it? And being the smart negotiator that Eleazar was, okay, he made him do an oath before he did it, before he gave him actually the money and turned it over and had him sign off on the document back then and stuff like that. But there's that word antilutron, in place of. And what happens in this case, the temple objects go free. See, they're free from this. Okay. Now, the New Testament passages that we're going to look at divides into three groups of passages. You've got the first group are the Old Testament style corporate redemption. Remember, when we study the Old Testament, not only were individuals redeemed, not only were they freed from abusive situations and maleficent situations, but also groups were. You know, God could redeem my family, God could redeem the nation Israel, and that was what was supposed to happen in the future. And they were all hoping at the time, around the time of Christ, that a Messiah would come, a ruler would come, that would redeem the whole nation. And so that Israel would now get freed out from under the Roman Empire and be put up in the trophy case, right? Instead of just being subjugated nation like all the other nations were around Rome. And so there was still that corporate hope. And we do have lutron used in three passages that look like they're talking about that kind of hope. And they're all in Luke. His father, Zechariah, was filled with the Holy Spirit and prophesied. Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, because he has come and redeemed his people. He has raised up a horn of salvation for us in the house of his servant David. As he said through his holy prophets of long ago, salvation from our enemies and from the hand of all who hate us. Okay, now this is John the Baptist. When John the Baptist, the forerunner, remember the closing book of the Old Testament, said, suddenly the Lord's going to come to his temple. The Lord whom you seek is coming to his temple. And there's a passage about the forerunner, that there was a forerunner. Elijah was going to come. Somebody like Elijah, strange and striking and very verbal. Okay, and somebody was going to come with that level of confrontation ability, like Elijah. Okay. And that's John the Baptist. And when, boom, that happens, in return to an angelic disclosure, there have been theoretically no angels for several hundred years, supposedly up to this time. His father Zechariah was filled with the Spirit, and he prophesied, praise be the Lord God of Israel, because he has come and redeemed his people. In other words, it's so confident that God has broken in that he can thank him that it's already done. It's like when those people try to manipulate with those management memos to say, thank you in advance. For your attention, right? You know, that kind of thing. You know, this is a different model altogether. It's not trying to manipulate God with this, but he's redeemed his people. But the redemption was that last verse, salvation from our enemies and from the hand of all who hate us. See, that's more that national thing. That's more that national oppression, the fact that the nations of the world constantly still oppress one another. Every chance you get, power changes, they go back into various types of oppression, economic, military, you know, it could be any number of things. And then the next verse was similar. There was also a prophetess, Anna, the daughter of Phanuel of the tribe of Asher. She was very old. She had lived with her husband 7 years before her marriage. That's after her marriage. And then was a widow until she was 84. She never left the temple, but worshipped night and day, fasting and praying. coming up to them at that very moment. Now, this is the couple, Mary and Joseph and the baby Jesus, at about 8 days old. She gave thanks to God and spoke about the child to all who were looking forward to the redemption of Jerusalem. Now, she's the second evangelist that we have in the Bible about Jesus. Who was the first set of evangelists? Do you remember? Actually, no, at the birth of Jesus, there was a group that went in and told all the town all the wonderful things they had seen, the shepherds. And, of course, they were despised. They were not allowed to be witnesses in Jewish culture at all. And the second set of people, or the second person, that was the evangelist for the birth of Christ was a woman, Anna, the prophetess. And she would not be allowed, except in capital cases, to be a witness in Jewish law either. So you get this thing about God's just going to turn everything on its head. Everything on its head. Every kind of hierarchical thing you've ever seen, business as usual. He's going to say, this is not business as usual. I'm going to turn this thing up, and I'm going to make you look at this again. You're going to rethink this. We're going to get from having a form of godliness but no power thereof. I'm going to take you to Pentecost. I'm going to take angry, belligerent fishermen that want to call fire down on the Samaritans and judge them. And I'm going to take one of them, John, and turn him into an apostle of love by the time he gets to the end of his life. I'm going to show you what power the empty tomb looks like in real life. Not the spectacular, you know, fireworks displays, but I'm going to show you something that's more precious than gold than you could possibly imagine. I'm going to take this impulsive leader, Peter, who is always just trying to ride it over. He's always got his own management agenda, trying to stop the Son of God. So, nope, don't talk about this. We're not going to do it this way, Jesus. You know, just not going to do this to become somebody that becomes so flexible that he gets in trouble for his flexibility in Galatians with Paul. And in Jerusalem, when they try to work through it, he says, look, you know, I wanted to do it this way. I didn't even want to go talk to Cornelius, that pagan. I didn't want to. But I'm a slow learner. But after God did this thing about the sheet on the roof 3 times, I said, well, maybe this is what he was talking about. And so this stubborn, bullheaded, impulsive person ends up writing 1 Peter and ends up being a sweet spirit. And you sit there and say, yeah, there's hope for Glenn. There's hope for me. There's hope. And that's what, you know, the kinds of things that they were looking for. God just turned it over. He says, look, I'm going to show you. I'm going to change this stuff. And when you toggle into despair mode, you think about these people. Peter, you think about John, you think about the empty tomb, you think about Saul of Tarsus, the most zealous person I've ever met, you know, in literature at all. And a zealot, remember, the definition of a zealot is a person who, after having lost sight of his goal, doubles his efforts. Okay, that's a zealot. Okay, to make up for that loss of vision, we're going to work twice as fast toward the old goal. I've worked for people like that, so I know what I'm talking about. And then the last one on the old style was the chief priest and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And he, this is Jesus, said to them, how foolish you are and how slow of heart to believe all the prophets have spoken. Did not the Christ have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? Now, what you've got, this is that road to Emmaus. This is after the resurrection. And you've got two of the disciples walking on this trip. They're traveling. And Jesus appears to them but doesn't open their eyes. Because their eyes were heavy from grief. And they don't recognize him. And so he's talking. He says, what's going on? And they said, are you the only stranger in Jerusalem that hadn't heard all this stuff? You know, and then he goes through and says, somebody came here. There was just Jesus of Nazareth. We had hoped that he was going to be the one that was going to redeem Israel. See, but they killed him. Our leaders decided that apparently he wasn't. And they killed him. And then I omitted the verses that said, and what's more, this is the third day, and something's wrong with his tomb. We can't find his dead body, and we've heard strange things, strange rumors from women, the first witnesses of the resurrection, the same thing. Something's weird. And Jesus says, in good first century Semitic affectionate terms, oh, foolish you are!
how foolish you are, you know. And how slow of heart to believe all the prophets have spoken. Did not the Christ have to suffer these things and enter His glory? In other words, it was so clear. These events are after the book of Mark. Now, remember, we went through a bunch of passages of things Jesus said through the book of Mark. And they always look back at that suffering Messiah in Isaiah. Right? And you would think that at the end of having this 3 years with Jesus and them rubbing this in about we're going to go and die in Jerusalem. Now listen to me, I'm going to tell you again. Son of Man, we're going to go to Jerusalem. He must have said it 8 times that we have recorded in Scripture where He was just trying to rehearse with them ahead of time. We're going to go. I'm going to die, be scoffed and spit upon and all these kinds of stuff. And they didn't get it. They still didn't seem to get it until the very end. And so he's trying to say, look, I tried to get this across to you. Did not the Christ have to suffer these things before entering His glory? It wasn't just ended there. Remember, there was that tomb, and then there's this glory thing. But this kind of redemption, we hoped He was the one that would redeem Israel. See, and that's that big kind of corporate, national redemption to change them from being the tail into the head again in the Deuteronomy terms. Now, if you turn the page, you'll have a chart, an Excel spreadsheet. For those of you who've been lost so far, this is an Excel spreadsheet. And these are the passages in which Lutron and anti-Lutron are in the New Testament. Okay? And we're going to go through each one of these. And if you remember the, what was that called? Audience participation that we tried back where I had the 5 things and I would go through this, this, and this. I put these on a graph for us this time. So if you'll notice there, I've got, this is on page 14. I've got the, going from left to right. The verb that's used, Lutron, the verse, Mark 10:45, there's the verse. And then I've got a catch said, therefore, because sometimes you'll get a statement about redemption, and then the writer will say, therefore something. And they'll draw an implication of this truth. Okay, and whatever that is, if the verse has got it, we'll put it in the therefore. We'll have what we're redeemed from. If you remember when we went through the various things that sort of enslave us. We had, we had greed and materialism. We had various types of addictions. We had death. We had the consequences of our moral failures that should be in place. There were a number of these oppressors or things that either had right over us or overpowered us. And sometimes they're mentioned and they'll go in the from. He redeemed us from such and such. We'll see if the verse has got a price. You know, is there some emphasis or some point made about how much this cost? We'll have who was the agent doing this. Remember, because this is a commercial transaction. Remember, if Glenn, I'm owned by an owner, and then if somebody comes and buys me, they are the buying agent, right? And then they take out money and they pay something, right? So we've got a price, and then we've got who does the buying. Okay. As we pointed out last time, it never focuses on who was the seller who had me in captive, other than we had one real explicit, and we'll see a couple of froms. But they're generally just sort of either like extremely bad habit patterns or consequences of my moral behavior, I'm under judgment kind of thing. But it's never a personal agent per se. The for column has to do, if I'm redeemed, what for? In other words, I'm set free. Remember, in Roman servitude, in Roman slavery, when I was a servant, if I was freed by my owner, I still had some responsibilities back to the owner. Remember, we talked about a consulting retainer. I got put on a consulting retainer, and I had to give X number of days a month in work back to my owner. Now, I got paid for that, and typically, the owners would also do that for risk spread, by the way, because a lot of times, the servants that they, the first ones that got freed were like banker types. So I would be a banker, and I proved myself quite worthy there and smart and did this. I would get freed, and I would have the money I'd earned as a servant, and then we would do a joint venture. And so the owner would go into another bank or expand the banking operations, maybe go to the internet and have an e-commerce site or something of this type, and we would do a joint venture out of my money that I'd earned and that money. Okay? And so there might be a for clause. I'm freeing you for this task. I've got a very specific design. I want you to continue to be a banker. or I want you to represent me overseas in some commercial thing in those days that you owe me as part of that, if at all possible. And then the subject is who, if I was the captive, who exactly was the subject of that ransom? And then other one is just a column for if there are any other nuances of the verse. So if we go through it, look at the first one, and you'll still have a chance to get these correct since they're already written in here when I ask this. Although they're not complete, I've got a couple that are blank. But I'll let you know ahead of time when we get there. Yes? Actually, 1, 2, and 3 were due to formatting. They were the previous three verses we saw. I don't think I numbered them. No, I didn't number them. But that was items 1, 2, and 3, actually. I sorted them by type. Okay. If some of you need an actual spreadsheet to do your own manipulations, just let me know. I'll bring a diskette next time I'm here. Good question. Okay. Didn't want to throw you off there. Okay, so the first one was the one we looked for. Even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. And notice the parallel passage in Matthew, that item 5, just is exactly the same wording, right? Because it's the same event, of course, in the life of Jesus. Now, there's no therefore in the verse. There's no implication drawn. Okay, there's no being ransomed for. But what is the price? It's pretty clear. His life. His life is to be given. The agent is the Son of Man. And the Son of Man, for our intents and purposes, is a figure, the Son of Man that shows up in the Old Testament. Most of the time the phrase shows up is in Ezekiel, where he's talking about the prophet. And it shows up in the book of Daniel as well to some future figure that's also put on a throne equal with God somehow. And you can imagine the rabbis had a real problem with that. And they were constantly fighting one another and excommunicating one another as to why we had two thrones up there. If you only have one God, and if the Messiah can't be God and man at the same time, you can't have two thrones. And so they would try to say, why we got two thrones up there then? And they'd say, well, when God is the best way they came up and resolved this was that when God is doing justice, he sits on one throne. When he's going to do mercy, he gets off and walks over to the other throne and gets up on it. So he just, separation of task, apparently. But the Son of Man in Ezekiel is this prophet, this exilic prophet, who bears the sin of Israel and Judah for X number of days in this symbolic ritual, lays on his side and bears the sin of Israel. And he has this horrible message that he has to deliver to an extremely stubborn people. But he is the prophet, and the prophet in exile. He doesn't see the glory. He hasn't seen, but he's seen the throne room vision of Yahweh. And he's been put under, he has this very close relationship with God. And so that's the kind of Son of Man image that we've got going that Jesus applies to himself. So the agent is Son of Man. We don't have a for. And the subject was for many. Okay. Now, for many is an Old Testament phrase when it wants to say for all. So when Daniel said, in the future, many that sleep in the dust of the earth shall rise. Okay. When Jesus quotes that in John, he says, all of those that sleep in the dust shall rise. In Isaiah 53, it uses the phrase, he poured out his soul as a ransom for many. Okay, that's the phrase that Jesus, he just quote, basically pointing back to Isaiah 53. Okay, so we got it for many. And you have a clear purpose statement there about came to serve, not to be served, but to serve. Okay. There's a very strong sense, let me be real clear here at exactly 11 o'clock, that there's a sense that this never changes. I'll be 50 this year. The second 25 years of my life have been spent walking with God. God broke into my life halfway through so far. And we're still working on this, needless to say. And as I go through this, the way I used to understand this verse was, yeah, he didn't come to be served this first time. But when he comes the second time, he comes to be served as a triumphant Lord. And then the more you read this book, you say, no, it never changes. When he comes as the ruling Messiah, the King, it is to produce justice among the nations and to judge and bring healing And so it's not that the praise and stuff that's supposed to be elicited from us is supposed to be this voluntary, spontaneous response to love. Just an effusive, that surprised by grace kind of response. See? And so there's an element where worship is, if you'd use the word demanded, because it's got some strong passages that says, but the opposite of worship was violent hatred of. You know, there wasn't a calm quietness kind of model at all there. It was just, why do the nations rage against the Lord and His Messiah? And the opposite of that, they will come to Jerusalem and worship. And remember, worship was the party. Remember, worship was when you brought the animals and you shared them with everybody and you had a feast. So there's a strong element in which you have to still understand that God is still that way. And His heart doesn't seem to change. There'll be a matter where worship will be required because it's strictly honesty. Because once all the ambiguity gets ripped off of human experience, when there is literally this glowing deity again in Jerusalem, you know, and every nation has to come there once or twice a year, and it's, your face is in it. It's like the people say, why didn't God skywrite it in the sky? You know, every morning now, skeptic will sometimes say, you know. And we have a level of ambiguity now because to keep it personal, to keep it a matter of drawing out our heart. But that's another story for another time. But right now, I just want to point out that this coming to serve is still part of that basic nature of love that is God. He's after it. Remember, before we were even, you know, a speck of relative derivative existence, okay, they were loving one another in the Trinity. They were honoring one another in the Trinity. They were after each other's honor and glory. And it was out of that love that spilled over and created us. Because that love was so effusive and said, let's make more. Let's make some communities like us and let others know what this is like. And that was what creation was sort of all about. We were a gift to the Son from the Father. All things were created through Him and for Him. We were a present. We were a present. Would that we would see God this way more, you know? Would that we would see God this more. And lest I would model God inappropriately and be way over time, let's close in a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for your good heart. We thank you for your love, that you just literally laid this out for us in the middle of history, just in this abysmal execution and death, this thing that you call a triumph that we can look at and say, my freedom is right there. Right there, my healing is there. There's hope. I can literally see that something is different in the universe, that somehow there's real power, that there's something real here instead of just the games and religious charades and acting out and play. You know, there's something real there that created life from the death. And Father, we just ask that we would see this more and that we would understand that that freedom that you offer us, that you've procured for us already and by coming to earth deliberately, doing this deliberately, and that we might get enough freedom that we would turn around and see that price and see that heart and fall in love with you, inescapably in love with you, that we would let our guard down before you, God. Tear away our stereotypes of your beautiful Son, and may we see Him and honor Him and walk close with Him as we try to introduce others to this love and as we try to experience more of this and respond in a warm and trusting relationship the way life is supposed to work. Guide us as we go forward this week and bring us back safely together in another couple weeks. Change us, Lord, and help us to be what we want to be too, what we really deep inside want to be. Thank you that there's a power to do this, and that power is in you and in your Son. We ask this for your Son's sake, for his achievement in our lives of happiness, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, goodness, the things against which there is no law. Amen.